I want to assemble some completely familiar points having to do with practical reason and the nature of human agency, which, when assembled in just this way, might make it seem both natural and right to conclude that the world contains value properties that make normative demands on us. I would hesitate to say that such a conclusion suggested by considerations such as those I present is properly called realism about values. Thus, for instance, for those who seek moral realist conclusions in order to repudiate a moral relativism will find nothing on offer in these remarks to promote their cause. For all I say, there might be substantially differential perception of the value properties in the world by subjects, say, from different cultural backgrounds, and should that ring alarm bells about a relativism in the offing, there will be nothing in what I say that would hush those alarms. I'm not by any means, a relativist, but that is for reasons that will not be detectable in the points I'm about to assemble. And relativism apart, even some of the other standard themes and interests surrounding questions of realism, such as the mind independence of the reality at stake, will not be addressed by me. And in fact, it might appear to many that there's far too much mind dependence in the conception of values that I present. I don't myself think that the sort of mind dependence I allow does anything to cancel or even qualify the claim that values are genuine and irreducible properties in the world. But I realize that there are realists who will even so find the claim in these respects falling measurably short of what they conceive realism to be. There's nothing to do but to acknowledge that that might be so and proceed. Let me begin with a familiar distinction, sometimes attributed to Spinoza, between the character of predictions and the character of intentions regarding one's own future behavior. When one predicts that one will do something, one steps outside of oneself and looks at oneself as the object of behavioral and causal and motivational tendencies. One looks at oneself as another might look at one, and so this is sometimes called the third-person point of view on oneself. But when one intends to do something, one is asking, what should I do, or what ought I to do? One is being an agent, not an observer of oneself. One is a subject rather than an object, and that is why this is sometimes described as a first-person point of view on oneself. Even when intentions to do something are not formed as deliberatively decisional answers to explicit questions of this sort, they're distinctly within the first-person point of view by contrast with predictions of one's behavior. Quick caveat, the rhetoric of first-person and third-person might give the impression of being merely grammatical categories involving the first and third-person pronoun, but the perspectival categories that the distinction between intention and prediction invokes are philosophical categories, and they do not coincide with the grammatical ones. Proof of this failure of coincidence can be found in examples such as when someone says, I predict that I will, when one grammatical term does double duty. The first occurrence of the first personal pronoun, I, in I predict that I will, is an agentive use, and the second occurrence refers to oneself as an object of detached study or observation. For this reason, we may perhaps be better off using not first and third person point of view, but the engaged point of view and the detached point of view, but I'll just fall into perhaps the other vocabulary because it's so prevalent. With whatever terminology we describe it, the point is to put on record a relatively clear and sharp distinction between two points of view on oneself. We can have both these points of view on ourselves, though we cannot have them both at the same time. The one crowds the other out. If we occupy both, we do so by defecting from one to the other, occupying each in turn. And given its nature, if we did not ever possess or occupy the first-person point of view on ourselves, we would have abdicated our agency. Okay, so that's going to show up later on. Now, though as I've presented them, these are distinguishable points of view on oneself, it is natural to think that there ought also to be a similar distinction of points of view we have on the world. We can have a detached perspective on it, a perspective of study, as is paradigmatically found in natural science, though that is just one very regimented and systematic form that the perspective takes. And we can have a perspective of agency on the world as well, and not just detached study, one of responding to it with practical engagement rather than with detached observation and explanatory purpose. Here again, there's scope for being misled. The point is not that we are not agents when we are observing and explaining the world in scientific terms, but that we as agents are taking a perspective of detached observation or study on it rather than one of practical engagement. One does not cease to be an agent when one has a detached perspective on the world. One just treats the world as an object of detached study rather than as something that prompts our practical engagement. So, these contrasting points of view one has can apply to oneself, as in the I intend and I predict, or as well as onto the world. So let's consider the latter when it their points of view on the world, and ask the question, what must the world be like? What must the world contain such that it moves us to such practical engagement over and above a detached observation and study of it? If the world prompts such engagement, it must contain elements over and above those we observe and study from a detached point of view. A natural answer to the question is that over and above containing the facts that natural sciences study, it contains a special kind of fact, evaluative facts and properties, or more simply, it contains values. And when we perceive them, they put normative demands to us and activate our practical engagement. Values, being the sort of thing they are not primarily the objects of detached observation. They engage with our first rather than our third person point of view on the world. Thus, if we extend in this way onto the world a presupposition of the fundamental distinction between intention and prediction, the presupposition of these two points of view on oneself, if we extend it onto the world, we get a conception of values that is not something we generate with our mental tendencies, our desires and moral sentiments, and then project those onto the world in the familiar metaphor, but they're properties that are found in the world, a world of nature, of others who inhabit nature with us, and of a history and tradition that accumulates in the relations among these. and within which value is understood as being in the world. It's not as if sympathy and moral sentiments are left out of this picture, but sympathy and moral sentiments on this picture are responses to the normative demands that we apprehend in our perceptions of a richly laid out set of properties in the world. This by now utterly familiar understanding of values, sometimes in recent years attributed to Aristotle, therefore seems something that can be motivated by the most commonsensical considerations about what is distinctive about agency and its unique point of view on the world as opposed to ourselves. But motivating some thought or conclusion may merely make it seem natural, something one could come to believe without strain, given the motivating factors, it doesn't yet approach the prestige of an argument. I think we can go a step further towards that form of rigor if we ask and attempt to answer the following question, intended as a challenge to the view. Why can't agency consist, this is the challenge to this picture, why can't agency consist in nothing more than the fact that we try and fulfill our desires, intentions, and so on? True, there is a first-person point of view that is activated and exercised in agency, but why can't it simply be exercised merely in our efforts to satisfy our desires and fulfill our intentions? Why do I insist that agency comes into play only when our desires and moral sentiments are responding to the callings of something external, the evaluative properties in the world? Why can't our characterization of desires have them be self-standing, independent of the need for such an external calling? That's the challenge. I call it the challenger's view of desires and agency. To answer it, we need to look a little harder at the relationship between desires and agency. Gareth Evans, in a now oft-cited passage, has said illuminatingly that questions put to one about whether one believes something, say whether it's raining outside, do not prompt us to scan our mental interiority to see whether we possess that belief. They prompt us to look outside and see whether it's raining. So we do the same thing whether we are asked, is it raining? And if you're asked, do you believe it's raining? Now, I'd like to extend this insight and ask, is this true of questions put to one about whether one desires something? When someone asks, do you desire X, are we prompted to ponder our own minds, or are we prompted to consider whether X is desirable? Of course, X's desirability may not always be perceptible to us if X is not sensibly present to us, but I'm assuming that something like perception is basic and that when we try and imagine the desirability of X, or just even reflect on its desirability, these are capacities that depend on some background of past perceptions. If not of X itself, then perhaps ingredients of X, or things sufficiently approximating or analogous to X, and so on. This point is generally true of imagination, whether of value properties or any other kind of properties. In any case, to return to the question, what does one do when one is asked whether one desires X? I think the answer, I mean, not invariably, but frequently, often enough, is that though there may be special sorts of case where we might ponder our own minds, say when an analyst asks a patient to introspect on desires, given that his behavior suggests a desire other than what the patient avows, for the most ordinary cases, it would be quite natural simply to consider X's desirability. This suggests that our desires are often presented to us as having desirabilities in the world as their objects, which, putting subtle differences apart, might be just the thing that is intended by the Aristotelian picture of values we are seeking to defend. But since it's an argument we are seeking to provide, we should persist a little more and ask, even if there's room for extending Evans's point about beliefs to many desires in this way, why is it so important to find it extendable in this way to desires? What makes it seem a philosophical necessity that we do this? Perhaps the best way to answer this question is to look critically at what would seem to follow if one thought my extension of Evans's point would be wrong. If one thought that the question about whether one desires something never requires one to consider its desirability, but rather to step back and consider by scanning our minds whether we desire it, then that would suggest that our desires, this is the crucial point, that our desires were presented to us in a way that was accessible to us only when our angle on ourselves was, to use my earlier term, in the third person. Okay, so I'll repeat that. If my extension of Evans is wrong, then when one asks the question about whether one desires something, if it never requires one to consider its desirability, then it would seem that our desires are given to us when one steps back and considers the desires in third person. And here we go back to the earlier point of the two different points of view, not on the world, but on ourselves. If it's indeed true, as we said in that discussion, that practical agency is present in the possession and exercise of the first person rather than the third person point of view on ourselves, then it would seem that to exercise our practical agency the appropriate way, the appropriate way for our desires to be given to us would have to be not when we step back and look at our desires from the outside, but that they are given to us in the perception of desirabilities. So the crucial point is that the desires are given to us indirectly through the perception of desirabilities if we are going to be agents in the way we possess desires. What alternative is there for our desires being present to us? And the answer, it would seem, would have to be by perceiving the desirability of what is desired, our desires given to us. Right? In the perception of desirabilities in the world, our desires are given to us indirectly. In short, if our desires were always experienced by us only as desired by us, our very agency would be in jeopardy. And it would only be restored if we found a way of saying that our desires are given to us not as desired and therefore available only to the agency threatening third-person point of view, but rather in the first-person point of view, when we are perceiving the desirability of what we desire, where no stepping back is involved. It is only when we experience them in this latter form that we are in the perspective of the first person that carries our agency. In other words, when we step back and register that we desire something, that desire cannot induce the agentive aspect of our mentality. The desire just sits there as the latent object of our detached gaze. And so the challenge before us, with its claim that our agency consists in just our possession and pursuit of self-standing desires, is exposed as insufficient, because it is only when our desires are not self-standing, but given to us via desirabilities in our perception, that they will possess the motivating power of practical agency. If, in order to be practical agents, we must be able to experience our desires not directly as elements located in our minds, but via the perception of values or desirabilities in the world, what does this suggest about the nature of value properties in the world? Any answer to this would unearth what lies behind my extension of Evans's point. It would be helpful here, by way of analogy, to recall a view of agency and responsibility that owes to Strawson's remarkable essay, Freedom and Resentment. On Strawson's view, it's via our reactive attitudes, such as resentment of what someone has done, that we may identify the agency and responsibility in her doings. There's no more direct certification of agency. That thought in general suggests a complex relation between our desires or emotions as directed at people and the facts about people's doings. Relations between resentments and their doings. Aristotle had said of emotions that they are which are directed at others, that they presuppose certain beliefs about others in the subject who undergoes emotions. Thus, for instance, Aristotle said, both in De Anima and in the Rhetoric, that my anger at someone presupposes the belief that he has done me harm. But if Strawson is right, presupposes is the wrong description for what's going on here. If he's right, the relations are not quite like that. Rather, the relation is more like the one we find in some accounts of pain, physical pain. On some accounts, pain is a way of perceiving parts of one's body. So, take the toothache. We may perceive a tooth tactually by touching it with a finger. We may go to a mirror and unfurl a lip and perceive it visually. But we may also more internally and involuntarily perceive it by, and here we sort of run out of the logical grammar, by paining it. And emotions are, in this sense, often similar. Often when we are angry with someone, it's not as if the belief that he has done one harm is all in place before the anger, and then the anger wells up, as the notion of presupposition suggests. One's anger is often a way of perceiving that he has done one harm. And I'm claiming that the right view of the relationship between our desires and the value properties in the world is something like that. I'd said earlier that to be practical agents, we must often perceive values or desirabilities, and in doing so, experience our desires indirectly rather than directly, as when we step back and scan them as part of our mental interiority. And what that suggests is that desires are, just as in the Strawsonian picture, are really our conduits for perceiving the value properties in the external world. This shows that we need to be a little careful when we say that value properties in the world make a normative demand on us. It's not as if the value properties which prompt our desires are a source of normative promptings that are entirely alien to the kind of sensibility we have in having desires. Though they prompt our desires, it is through the desires they prompt that we even so much as see the normative demands they make on us. So that's the mind dependence. And it's possible that this is what McDowell had in mind when he mentioned the analogy with secondary properties, but there's no evidence that the notion of agency is used in that way, and that argument is, in any case, to the extent that it's an argument in McDowell, is just not on the surface. I mean, I'm not sure what his reasons are, but the reasons I'm offering are entirely to do with these considerations of agency. In the argument that I've presented for the conclusion that the world contains values, the notion of agency has been crucial. The notion of practical agency requires that our desires are responses to normative demands made on our agency by these value properties. But the conclusion of the argument is not merely the conclusion that our desires are responses to promptings from something or other in the external world. The conclusion is that the external properties that they prompt, are value or moral properties that make normative demands on our agency. But for that reason, what is prompted by these external callings had better not be described in purely normative terms, purely descriptive terms. Or to put it more specifically, the notion of desires in question better not be, as Saul Kripke might have put it in the Wittgenstein book, they better not be purely dispositionally described. For if desires are merely described in descriptive terms, as dispositions, then it's not obvious that the entire picture that emerges is not a form of realism in which the value properties in the world can eventually be understood reductively in naturalistic terms, prompting, in the sense of merely causing, our desires rather than making irreducibly normative demands on us. So it would be a little bit like Peter Railton's external idea that value properties are, which are part, intended as part of a scientific realist picture, are. In general, the term desires, as we perfectly well know, is ambiguous between desires conceived as genuinely and irreducibly intentional states, which are themselves thought of in essentially normative terms, and desires conceived as dispositions or tendencies of nature, the nature within us. The argument for irreducible value properties in the world is therefore incomplete until we have some reason to think that there is a notion of desires in play in my extension of Evans's insight that is not to be thought of in these naturalistic dispositional terms. This subject, as I've already hinted, is a special case familiar from Kripke's point in the rule-following discussion. Kripke made a clean distinction between dispositions and normative states. And those normative states, when they are describing states of mind, are perhaps best described by the term that Robert Brandom has used widely, but Isaac Levi before him had used the word for the same things, which is the term commitments. So in Kripke's book, we have a clean distinction between dispositions and commitments, and it's good to compare Kripke's view here with another view, which is Donald Davidson's view of beliefs and desires, which does see them as dispositions, even though Davidson was one of the first to say that desires and beliefs are irreducible for reasons having to do with normativity. But Davidson never took the view that desires and beliefs are commitments. And in my concluding remarks, I want to show why it's very significant that one takes Kripke's line on this rather than Davidson's, because we need to establish for the form of moral realism that I've offered that the causal links are to something which are not non-normatively characterized but irreducibly normatively characterized, commitments rather than dispositions. Right? What they prompt are not dispositions but commitments. So here's the issue. The issue is, we have a picture flowing from Kripke which declares a clean distinction between say commitments and dispositions. Commitments is not Kripke's word, it's Brandom's word, but it's the point of Kripke's book. And there's Davidson's picture in which dispositions, beliefs and desires are dispositions, but they're irreducibly normative, not because they are themselves normative states, i.e. commitments, but because they're answerable to principles of rationality, which no other dispositions are answerable to, not the dispositions that natural science studies. Right? So you have this austere picture in Davidson where the only, if you like, and this is how Davidson puts it, the only commitments we have are to the principle of rationality. Those commitments constitute our beliefs and desires, which are dispositions. Right? So the only commitments you have is this, these very few commitments to the principles of rationality. As Davidson puts it, there's no need to clutter the mind with normative states. The mind just possesses dispositions. They just happen to be irreducible because of the fact that they alone, as dispositions, are constituted by principles of rationality. Now, I'm going to just stop for... I'm going to say one last thing and stop here. Here's a simple reason why one should take Kripke's view rather than Davidson's. Take the following scenario. I believe that P. In a fit of distraction, when I'm asked a question, I assent to something that's inconsistent with P. Say, not P. To keep things simple, say, not P. So that's the scenario. I believe that P. In a fit of distraction, I assent to not P, or something inconsistent with P. Now, if Davidson is right, and not Kripke's view, then the instruction we get from Davidson is, clean up your logical act. Either give up your belief that P, or withdraw your assent to not P. That's all that Davidson can tell us, because he says the only commitments you have are to principles of rationality. So it just says, be consistent. Your instruction is either give up the belief that P or withdraw the assent to not P. But that's the wrong instruction to give in this scenario. In the scenario where one has assented to not P because one's distracted, the right instruction is withdraw your assent to not P. But Davidson doesn't have the resources to say that, because the only commitments you have are to the principles of rationality. But if you have, if your belief itself is a commitment, then it's very clear that the instruction should be withdraw assent to not P. So that's a reason to think that there is something that Kripke is right about. We need a cleaner break than Davidson offers. And Kripke's point is the clean break is dispositions, you just need normative states. And that's what desires are. And it's only when you establish that then the links between the perception of desirabilities and desires so conceived can ground the extension of Evans's insight that I'm appealing to in appealing to considerations of agency to establish that value properties are in the world. Okay, thanks.